Recently, scandal hit the international aid organisation Oxfam when it was found guilty of covering up sex abuse, endemic exploitation of power, and an internal culture of bullying. Much as I would like to focus on the enduring truth that those who convince themselves that they are the most virtuous and who are loudest about it have a strange tendency to be among the first of those guilty of such abuses, I would prefer instead to use this as an opportunity to shine a spotlight on the economics of international aid. The UK currently spends £13.5 billion a year on aid. This is part of international virtue signalling compliance, otherwise known as the 0.7% of GDP that developed UN nations are supposed to commit to foreign aid. As a side note, I am always interested by countries like Denmark, who routinely manage to hit that target while failing to comply with the 2% of GDP it is meant to spend on defence as a NATO member. But that's another story for another video. Over the past 50 years, the First World has sent more than $1 trillion of aid to Africa. But did this have the desired effect of eliminating poverty in that benighted continent? Far from it. Between 1970 and 1998, the poverty rate in Africa rose from 11% to 66%. Just as welfare in domestic policy traps communities in learned helplessness, so does welfare in international policy produce similar results, with even more depressing and devastating consequences. It was after the great increase in aid to sub-Saharan Africa that began in 1970 that per capita income dropped and many African countries endured negative growth. In fact, there is an inverse correlation between the amount of aid a country receives and its economic performance. In other words, the more aid a country gets, the more its GDP declines. In 1957, Ghana's GDP per capita was actually a little bit higher than South Korea's. 30 years later, it was lower by a factor of 10. Of course, stupid socialist domestic policies also play a role, but international socialism in the form of aid perverts the incentives and in some cases even corrupts those governments. For example, in Uganda, foreign aid accounts for 50% of the government's total budget. Think about that. One half of all the state's income comes from aid. But what does President Yoweri Museveni spend that money on? Russian Su-30 warplanes for his Air Force and Gulfstream private jets for himself. One of the hidden costs of aid comes in the form of the market-distorting effects of aid workers themselves on local economies. Let me go through a scenario. Let's imagine we're in a town in Congo. Let's call it Goma. Here, the average annual salary is $400. Child labour is common. Now, before your heart starts bleeding like leftists, please remember that every child that does not work in such a place will cost their family and themselves crucial income and therefore food. So regulation banning such practices would actually condemn these people to even more tragic poverty. You'll note that a local militia is on hand to extort and terrorize these people who already live in abject conditions. In fact, economics fans, it is exactly this exploitative and extractive relationship that one can see the real root causes of why some of these places are so poor in the first place. Political power and coercion block the flourishing of markets. There's also a doctor on hand, paid marginally more than local workers, but not much more. More about him in a second. Into this scene, enter the aid workers. These are people who will be on incredibly well-funded international aid missions. In short, they have money to burn. Remember, the average annual salary in this local economy is $400. And most of these aid workers will be earning more than that in 1 week. Now, let's trace the flow of capital as these heroic do-gooders come to the rescue. So naturally, the first thing they do is to give the local militia cash in exchange for safe passage and protection. Of course, this sum of money will be wildly beyond the dreams of the local economy and immediately gives the recipient bragging rights and prestige. The locals will see the foreigners effectively paying him tribute, so their iron grip on power is actually strengthened by the intervention. Next, what do these aid workers do? Well, of course, none of them can speak the local language or feel confident enough to drive on the roads there, which are probably quite unsafe for non-locals. And so they need both translators and drivers. The aid circus commonly pays local educated people $100 a day for such services. That's right, $100 a day when the average person earns $400 a year. And who are the people most likely to have such education and skills? That's right, the local doctor and anyone else in the local economy who is fortunate enough to have some education. Of course, who could refuse $100 a day? So effectively that means one less doctor for the local hospital, one less teacher for the local school. People sometimes say that those of us on the right have no heart, but this is the sort of thing that genuinely breaks mine. But what else happens? Enterprising people in the local economy see that foreign aid workers are flush with cash and so set up shops to sell goods and services at greatly higher prices. Just a few sales to a rich Westerner could be worth more than a month of sales to poor locals. And of course, this has the net effect of pushing up local prices. So now, some of the poorest people in the world have to suffer under a militia that has increased its strength and prestige. They have lost some of their most productive citizens who are now working as translators and drivers for foreign moralists, and they have to spend their meager wages on goods and services that are getting more expensive as opposed to cheaper. To think some aid workers actually use their elevated position in such a local economy to sexually abuse locals on top of this is enough to make one's blood boil. So what can Western powers really do to help these places? I somewhat like the ideas of Jacob Rees-Mogg on this. Let's hear what he has to say.
But I also think the overseas aid budget target is an error, that we should spend money sensibly with a good audit trail when it is needed. To say we will simply spend this money and we will spend it by the end of the year as a percentage of a figure that we do not know, so we're guessing at the end of the year and can be shoveling money out of the door to meet the target, that's a great mistake. And what should we do instead? Well, I think there's a really interesting opportunity that we could carry on helping in emergencies, which most people in the country think is a good thing to do. I think the country would be very proud of the work the UK has done in terms of refugee camps near Syria, where we've been second only to the United States, the biggest contributor to those, to try and solve the problem near where it arises rather than encouraging large numbers of refugees. But perhaps we should look, and this is my investment interest, in investment rather than in expenditure. That if you look at overseas aid, it pales in comparison with the flows going from the private sector. I think the figures are between 800 million billion, sorry, and $1 trillion each year go from the private sector into emerging markets. But that's investment in seeking a return. And I wonder whether the government ought to think about investing, as it does through the Commonwealth Development Corporation, and seeking a long-term return, and perhaps building up a sovereign wealth fund through the expenditure that's already committing. And that might be better value for the British taxpayer, achieve better outcomes for the poorest countries in the world, because investing with a return is often a more useful way of spending money than giving it to the Ethiopian Spice Girls or whatever temporary here today, gone tomorrow project you've decided to back. If the target is to be set in stone, it would go towards that target. It might not meet the technical rules, but it would go towards that target. And so I think there is another approach to overseas aid that could be taken.
Oh, and just a couple of little notes before signing off. I did a stream last night on a new channel called The Liberalists. I've linked it in the show notes. We had a chat about this and that, including the difference between classical liberals and conservatives. And my good buddy, the Britisher, just pointed out to me that I have passed 10,000 subs. The next edition of Unpopular Opinions, which is part 10, will double up as the 10,000 sub party. Thank you everyone who has watched and supported this channel so far. You guys give me hope every day that people can still see sense. Till next time.
I'd like to thank Sir Percy Blakely, the Crimson Satan, Franz Franz Franz, Graham Leggett, Ginger Bill, Michael Burt, Blake Barrows, Charles Vincent, and Edward Darren.